this is okay, as an awkward one. So this is really a didactic lecture, so not much interaction. And the goal of this lecture, like any other graduate course lecture, is to really make you familiar with some terminology, some concepts. Much of the information which I'm presenting may have some caveats associated with it, which I cannot clarify because of shortage of time. And also, like again, in any field of science, there are always new discoveries. Some of the things which I'm talking about may be updated, may be kind of factually correct in a few years' time. But again, the main goal is to get you familiar with some terms and concepts, and also with, you know, a small portion of nature's wonders and ingenuities of human scientists who do the work which unearths this knowledge. So, as Anand mentioned, I am in the Department of Thoracic Surgery. I do research. My research is currently focused on microRNAs and RNA editing. So this, I have about 50 slides, so I hope I can finish by 5 o'clock. And if you have to leave early to catch a shuttle or something, please feel free to do so. All this material is in the handout that you have received and also on the website. And again, there's much more information in books and review articles and so forth, and I'm sure you'll be able to find them. So this is again to give you an overview. So I've divided this talk into three sections. So we'll be talking about microRNAs. 89% of the talk is about microRNAs. And then a few slides on RNA modifications and RNA editing. I have added these topics because these are new, upcoming topics in biomolecular science, and people become familiar with them because they provide a new way to look at biological phenomena. So, microRNAs, I'm going to cover some aspects of these: history, biogenesis, nomenclature, tissue specificity, etc. What are their applications, how they are assayed, how they can be engineered, and so forth. And the same kind of outline is also will be used for RNA editing and modifications. So, microRNAs, they have been known for almost 25 years. The first microRNAs were discovered in the world, C. elegans, in 1993, and probably a lot of you know that this discovery was awarded with a Nobel Prize in the early 2000s. And it took about 7 years for the second microRNA to be discovered, so it wasn't until the beginning of the century that people really took notice of microRNAs. And just to discover the first microRNA, the biological phenomena which led to its discovery was identified actually 10 years prior to that. So there's a lot of work which people did to identify microRNAs and bring it into focus. Then some of the early, you know, like with, again within the field of study, there was a lab phase and a lot of new things came up. People identify how microRNAs are synthesized, their association with different diseases, cancers, and so forth. So today, microRNAs is, the field of microRNAs is really a mature field, I would say. MicroRNAs are known to be expressed in all eukaryotes. So currently we know about 2,600 human microRNAs, about 2,000 microRNAs in the mouse, and again, hundreds of microRNAs in small organisms such as fruit fly, C. elegans, plants, and so forth. So microRNAs are really at the main physics, they're ultra-short RNAs. They're only 18 to 22 nucleotides. So if you were to look at an mRNA, you know, they are like noodles, they are 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 nucleotides long. On the other microRNAs are really short. You can see them as, let's say, grains of rice, for example. And instead, they're present in all eukaryotes. And they're also encoded by genes of viruses. So viruses, which infect cells, human cells, for example, they encode for microRNAs. And these microRNAs, which are generated in these infected cells, also affect the behavior of cells. So there are genes for microRNAs. So, for example, there are standalone genes whose only product is a microRNA. So, for example, there's a microRNA called microRNA-210 or MeTrigger-210, and there's a gene which goes by a similar name, MeTrigger-210, which produces just this microRNA. It has no other function. On the other hand, there are some microRNAs which are actually kind of byproducts of genes which encode for other proteins. For example, there's a transcription factor, TP63. The gene encodes a transcription factor, TP63, but it also produces a microRNA, goes by the name MIN944. So any cell, for example, where this transcription factor is active, you can imagine that this microRNA 944 will also be active. And in fact, people have shown that both the microRNA product and the actual protein product of this gene participate in the same cellular molecular pathways. So the genes for microns, the first transcript that they make, the primary transcript that they make, is what's called the primary microRNA or the prime microRNA. And this prime microRNA actually is processed in the nucleus into a secondary form, which is the precursor microRNA. This is something like how primary mRNAs get spliced, the introns of primary mRNAs get spliced out, so it's a mature mRNA, something like that. So the primary microRNA gets processed into a pre or a precursor microRNA, and the precursor microRNA actually use two different mature microRNAs. So you have two mature microRNAs produced from a single pre-microRNA. And this process occurs, half of it occurs in the nucleus. So you have the microRNA gene, which is transplanted to the primary microRNA, and then it gets screwed by certain enzymes in the nucleus, DROSHA and VGCRA. These are two proteins which form a complex, and that complex does endonucleotidic cleavage of this primary microRNA to produce the precursor microRNA. So precursor microRNA is a really short RNAs themselves, 60 to 80 to 90 nucleotides long, and they're characterized by this clear stem loop structure. And this precursor microRNA is exported out of the nucleus. There are well-known proteins such as exporting 5, which are known first in the export pathway. And there the precursor microRNA is recognized by another two well-known proteins, DICER and TRBP. They too, just like DROSHA and VGCRA, possess ribonucleic activity and they cleave this precursor microRNA to generate two mature microRNAs. These two mature microRNAs remain together as a duplex. And this duplex eventually gets loaded onto other protein complexes where they result in microRNA mediated action. We'll talk about that more later. But the end result of this microRNA mediated action is that the microRNA binds to certain target mRNAs, and that prevents translation of the mRNAs, or it enhances degradation of the mRNA. So microRNAs act by basically preventing translation, repressing translation from mRNAs, or by causing degradation of the target mRNAs. So the microRNA nomenclature, unlike our general gene nomenclature, has been quite systematic. So there's an organization called MIRBase, or microRNA database. It's a repository of microRNA sequences and annotation. So if you discover a new microRNA, you typically apply to this registry where they will assign a name. And this name assignment is quite systematic, and that's why microRNAs have these numerical suffixes in their names. So your names like microRNA 210, 375, 630. So it's quite impersonal, unlike any of the interesting gene names. And on top of these names, sometimes people add prefixes which indicate the species of the microRNA. So a microRNA 375 in mouse may be called MMU for mouse muscular with 375. Same way for Arabidopsis, you may add an ATH prefix indicating the species of the microRNA upon its reprinter. So coming back to the suffixes. So microRNAs, as I told you, the precursor microRNA, a single precursor microRNA produces two mature microRNAs. And so those two mature microRNAs are referred to with a 5P or 3P suffix. So for example, this is the precursor microRNA for human microRNA 210, it has a hairpin stem loop structure. And once it dies cleaves, you get two mature microRNAs, one indicated by this, which is microRNA 210-3P, because it's from the 3' part of the precursor microRNA, and from the 5' part you have the microRNA 210-5P. So the 5P and 3P really refer to where from the precursor microRNA the microRNA is arising. Then in order to a decade ago, 5 years ago, people were using another suffix, which is an asterisk or a star, to indicate which microRNA is more abundant, which microRNA of the two micromature microRNAs is less abundant, and so forth. So in case of microRNA 210, the 5P form tends to be less abundant, so people also refer to it as microRNA 210 star. Then there are other suffixes which people use. For example, if there are two microRNAs which are very similar in the sequence, maybe they have one or two nucleotides which are different from each other, then they would use a suffix with an alphabetical identity like A, B, C. So if you see microRNA 124A, you can imagine that there is also a microRNA 124B, and that the 5P, mature microRNAs from these microRNAs are similar in the sequence. Then people also use another type of suffix, which is a numerical suffix, which is to indicate identical microRNAs, but which are actually produced from different genes. So there's a micron-1941, which comes from a micron-1941 gene. And then there's also a micron-1942, which comes from a 1942 gene. The genes are different, but the sequence of these literal microRNAs are identical. Again, this is to give you an idea of how these things are named, because they can look very complicated. When you read papers or examine public data, which indicate innovative micron expression values and so forth. So microRNA genes themselves have a name which indicates microRNA, which arises from them. So microRNA 375 gene, microRNA 275, and then eventually primary and precursor microRNAs get added, prior and pre prefixes to the name. Then the mid base also assigns identities. So for mature microRNAs, they use mature microRNA identity, and then they also have just microRNA identity for precursor and pre-microRNAs and so forth. So if you were to go to the mirbase database, which is at mirbase.org, you can put in any microRNA, it will tell you sequences for different species, for the mature microRNA sequence, or the mature or the precursor microRNA sequence and so forth. Finally, there are families of microRNAs. So these are microRNAs which don't have that much similarity in the sequence except for certain regions. So the first 2 to 8 nucleotides of microRNAs are what are known as seed sequence regions. So these are primary determinants of the targeting of mRNAs by a microRNA. So microRNA families have identical seed sequences. So for example, here you have 5 different microRNAs come from 5 different genes, but they have identical seed sequence. So this indicates that this family of microRNAs, they all target similar mRNAs. So if you look at the expression of microRNAs, unlike the expression of mRNAs, the expression of microRNAs is relatively ubiquitous, meaning there are some microRNAs which are very specific to tissues, but in general, every microRNA tends to be expressed in every cell. There are, like I said, some exceptions. For example, there's the microRNA 124, which is largely expressed in brain and neuronal cells. On the other hand, there are microRNAs like microRNA 16, 21, you can see like the expression of these microRNAs at high levels in almost all tissues. So for example, this is data from a paper in 2007 where specific expression of microRNAs was analyzed, and you can see most microRNAs are, in this study, they're found to be expressed in almost all types of tissues, except for a few. For example, this microRNA 302 was present largely in embryos, but not in adult tissues. And although the expression of microRNAs is ubiquitous, you do still see changes in expression, meaning relative expression of microRNAs varying between different types of tissues, in different disease conditions, and so forth. So the signature of microRNAs can be used to identify particular types of cells or particular disease conditions. So, for example, in this paper, 60 cell lines in the MCI, cancer cell line panel, were examined by the microRNA expression. You can see clustering of the cell lines by the type of tissue of origin that they came from. So breast cancer cell lines tend to get clustered together by the microRNA expression, say the colon cancer cell lines, the leukemia cell lines, and so forth. So you can see specific patterns or groups of microRNAs indicating types of tissue, etc. But if you were to look at just one microRNA, you may not be able to say which tissue or disease or physiological condition it is specific for. So now we come to how microRNAs act. As mentioned, microRNAs act by targeting mRNAs, and the net result is that you have translation repression or you have degradation of mRNA. So the effective result is that you have reduction in protein number. Again, this is the general canonical overview of microRNAs, but there are known examples where microRNAs have been shown to actually increase protein translation. Some microRNAs have also been shown to enter into the nucleus to affect gene expression itself. So there are these less known mechanisms of action of microRNAs, but the primary mechanism is acting on mRNAs to prevent translation or to cause the degradation. And this happens through the incorporation of microRNAs in a protein complex which is called RNA-induced silencing complex or RISC complex. And this RISC complex also participates in the action of siRNA, small interference my audience will also make it by the same risk complex. So this risk complex has many proteins in it. The primary proteins are known as argonaut proteins. Humans have, for example, 4 argonaut proteins. So risk complexes contain these argonaut proteins, and they are basically they carry the microRNAs. And the entire risk complex with the microRNAs scans along mRNAs to identify sequences of complementarity where the microRNA risk complex binding increases, and so you have an effective binding of the risk complex to the mRNA at the target sites, and that prevents ribosomal protein translation, and in some cases it leads to endonuclear cleavage or degradation of the RNA. So again, as I previously mentioned, if the seed sequence of the first, second, to eighth nucleotide of the microRNA is participate in this targeting. So if you imagine an alignment of a target mRNA sequence with a microRNA sequence, it's really the first, second to eighth nucleotide of the microRNA which are important for this interaction. So if we have a good degree of complementarity here, it doesn't matter if you have poor complementarity elsewhere, it's likely that this target is enough for the mRNA to be called the target of the microRNA, resulting in binding of the risk complex and degradation or protein translation inhibition. So this complementarity is what determines targeting, but it tolerates imperfection, so you don't need absolute complementarity. So the current model is that once the mature microRNA is made, it's in a duplex form, you have the 5P and the 3P together. One half of it gets loaded, meaning either the 5P or 3P on the risk complex. And in this example, it's the argonaut 2 protein which scans this mature microRNA, and it scans along RNA sequences using the seed sequence nucleotides. And once it identifies that there's some match, and the rest of the nucleotide sequences are used to look for further complementarity, and if it's a certain degree of complementarity, the risk complex stays there, and that prevents translation from occurring. And as I said, in some cases, also for degradation of the mRNA itself. So you can see, because of this tolerance for imperfection in sequence complementarity, you can have a single mature microRNA target many different mRNAs. Same way you can have many different microRNAs target the same mRNA. So this can be referred to as pleiotropic targeting by microRNAs. This is an example showing microRNA 145 targeting 3 different RNAs. In this case, these are all stem cell-associated mRNAs. And you can see, again, because of the complementarity at the seed sequence, that's enough to drive targeting 3 different mRNAs with the same microRNA. So this allows for biological pathways, for example, in this case, stem cell development, to be targeted by a single microRNA. On the other hand, we also have cases where you can find pathways that are targeted by multiple microRNAs. In this example, I show 4 microRNAs of a set of microRNAs, which are referred to as microRNA 17 to 92 cluster, because they happen to be close to each other. The genes for those microRNAs are close to each other on the genome, in the same chromosome. These microRNAs have different sequences, they have different seed sequences, but they all target a set of genes which are known to functionally interact with each other. So whenever you have gene expression of microRNA 17 to 92 cluster go up, all these genes, all these microRNAs, they target the same set of genes. So some of them will target particular genes, but the net result is that they all, as a group, target genes which are functionally interacting with each other. So you're able to suppress an entire pathway of genes, entire network of genes, using a few microRNAs. So again, because the target of mRNAs is dictated by sequence complementarity, people have developed different computational tools to predict whether a microRNA targets a particular mRNA or not. And there are a number of bioinformatic tools which have been developed over the years. They all rely primarily on whether there is a complementarity at the seed sequence region of microRNAs and mRNA, but they also look at other things. Some of them, for example, look at whether that sequence is conserved across species or not. And if it is, then they will say that the likelihood of true targeting is high. Say they will sometimes look at the secondary structure of the RNA and so forth. So they use different criteria. But still, these computational tools are not very accurate. And if you look at the overlap of these predicted targets of microRNAs between different computational tools, you find that the overlap is very, very little. So in this study, for example, from 2008, they are looking at overlap of targets predicted by different computational tools, and see the consensus is very poor, like 5% or less than 5%. So in general, if you were to see what microRNA, if you were to examine or investigate which microRNA targets your gene of interest, and you use all these computational tools, there's a high chance that you will get a false positive result. Still, it does help guide experimental design, and people use these tools to further study a pathway or a gene of interest.
Is the intersect like highly true?
Yeah, it is. So if you see something which is predicted by multiple tools, then it's likely that it's more likely to be true. So the false positivity goes down if you have multiple tools predicting the same thing. So once you have identified like a predicted targeting, you want to do experimental work to show that the targeting indeed happens. And there are many ways in which this targeting can be examined. Obviously, one simple way is to either overexpress or downregulate your microRNA and see if the protein is supposed to be targeted through the microRNA, if the protein levels go up or down. So if a microRNA is targeting a particular gene, then overexpression of the microRNA should further reduce the protein clearance of the gene, and vice versa. If you knock down the microRNA, you should see an increase in the protein product. Again, these effects could be indirect, but it's a partial indicator whether targeting is happening or not. There are also reporter assays. So this is a common reporter assay that people use. In this, you have a firefly insulin gene, and in the 3' and trisulfur region for the gene, you can insert your target sequence of interest. And then if microRNA is overexpressed along with the luciferase construct, and that microRNA targets, the mRNA target that has been introduced behind the luciferase gene, then you should see reduced luciferase reporter activity following co-transcription of the microRNA. Then people have also used immunoprecipitation-based methods because microRNAs act through the RNA protein in this complex. You can pull down using antibodies the risk complex itself and then check if you're able to pull down the target mRNA along with it. And finally, with next-gen sequencing becoming more, becoming cheaper and easier to use, people have also devised many methods which use next-gen sequencing methods to explore all the kinds of RNAs which a particular microRNA targets. So typically, the principle is to pull down this complex and then cross-link your microRNA and all of its interacting target RNAs using ultra-direct light or chemical methods, and then sequence whatever gets pulled down, and then you can identify what are the targets. So in general, a microRNA typically would target something like 500 to 1,000 different mRNAs. And same way, you can have one mRNA be targeted by 100, 200 different microRNAs. So how specific a target is, or how strong the targeting is, it depends on how many molecules of a microRNA are on. A particular microRNA may be able to strongly target an mRNA, but if it is not abundant in the cell, then the net effect is less. So there are all other parameters which have to be evaluated to judge whether a particular targeting of an mRNA by a microRNA is significant or not. So in terms of experimental work, about other aspects of microRNA studies. So microRNAs are just like RNAs. So So all the things which are done with, can be done with mRNAs can also be done with microRNAs. So when you typically when you extract RNA from a tissue specimen, blood, or standard of cells, you also bring down microRNAs with it. But there are some methods which are available to enrich for microRNAs. So if you use, for example, triazole or spin columns to extract RNA, you will collect microRNAs along with the mRNAs, but you can further enrich just for the small microRNA fraction using other methods. So for example, by changing atomic concentrations, affinity columns, chromatography methods, you can enrich or specifically include just the microRNAs in your isolation. Then you can use science exclusion chromatography or use hybridization to all the nucleotide proofs to specifically isolate microRNAs. But typically people will just extract total RNA, it will have microRNA in it, and the total RNA can be used for microRNA quantification. So if you were to extract total RNA from cells, for example, and run it on a gel and visualize RNA using ethylene bromide or some other fluorescent dye, you can easily see small RNA fraction in the 20-25 microbat range. And that will contain microns and things. So these bands can be cut off. So again, that's another way to isolate or enrich for small RNAs. Because of the small size, these small microRNAs are difficult to evaluate using bioanalyzer. But one can get an idea of how much RNA is there. The other drawback is that if you have degradation in your total RNA preparation, those degraded samples can appear as small RNAs. So for quantification, again, like RNAs, you can use absorbance at 260 nanometer to estimate concentration. Again, like any other absorbance spectrometry method, if the analyte concentration is really low, this method is kind of unreliable because of background absorbance by other chemicals. Then there are RNA-specific dyes like ribogreen, which can be used to measure microRNA concentration. And these dyes can be used in general to measure any RNA in concentration. So to add amount of microRNAs or specific microRNAs, there are a number of methods. Again, just like for RNA, which you use for gene expression studies, so you can use northern blotting in situ hybridization, microarrays, RT-PCR, RNA sequencing. There are all methods available to evaluate microRNAs, specific microRNA, or globally profile all the microRNAs in a particular sample. So it depends on other considerations also. So if you want to, for example, evaluate or localize whether a microRNA is present in a particular subset of cells in a tissue, you can do in situ hybridization. On the other hand, if you don't care whether it's in a particular subset of cells, you can just extract RNA from the whole population of cells and then examine that. And finally, as I mentioned, if you have degradation, for example, in case of formalin fixed tissues, the mRNAs get degraded and they can appear as microRNAs. So that's something one should keep in mind. For RT-PCR of microRNAs, so for again, select gene expression studies, you can use RT-PCR. The problem with RT-PCR studies is that because microRNAs are so short, only 18, 22, 23 nucleotides long, you need to have a good method to be able to amplify something. You need an amplicon to be PCR amplified. So people have come up with some interesting techniques. Use of stem RT primer is very common, and this what is done is that you have your RNA preparation, which contains mature microRNA, many mature microRNAs. And to that, a primer is added. So this primer has a stem loop structure. So part of the primer binds to a specific mature microRNA, but the rest of the primer folds on itself. So once reverse transcription is performed, this primer gets extended. So you have a longer cDNA, and that longer cDNA can then be amplified and quantified by real-time qPCR, etc. So this method allows for artificial increase in the amplicon size, so you're able to amplify a longer product. Otherwise, a short product is very difficult to to amplify. Then there's another method in which commonly used method, in which these microRNA preparations are poly-A-tailed using an enzyme. So that adds poly-A-tails to the three prime end of the microRNAs, and then you can use an oligo D prime to reverse transcribe this, and then this can be amplified by using qPCR. So RT-PCR is the most commonly used method to measure microRNA. Once you have, again, just like the gene expression studies, you need a normalizer to quantify how much microRNA is present across different samples. So there are some small RNAs or microRNAs which are commonly used for normalization in the case of microRNA RT-PCR studies. So U6B is a small nucleolar RNA. It is actually not a microRNA, but its size is small. It's like 40 to 50 nucleotides long. So it's used as a good surrogate for small RNAs, and it is typically used for normalization. Then for high throughput data, where you're looking at hundreds of microRNAs, there are mathematical methods, such as global mean normalization, quantile normalization, etc., that are used based on the type of platform that was used. But it was RNA sequencing, microRNA, RT-PCR. There are different methods that can be used to normalize your expression values so that you can compare microRNA expression across samples.
Yeah. The super small size of the RNA molecule, and also such a small overlap of the primer, and also with the C sequence that's common between microRNAs,
Yeah, that's a good question. Specificity is actually, it depends again on exact primer sequences. And also, so some microRNAs, for example, there's a group of LET7 microRNAs. There are actually 8 of these microRNAs in the LET7 family. They're identical to each other except for one nucleotide. So if you were to use, for example, the LET7A primer to do RT-PCR for LET7A, you may actually pick up LET7B, C, and so forth. So it depends on which company's products you're using or how carefully you design your primers. So typically people use TaqMan probe-based RT-PCR assays. So not only you have specificity because of the primers, you also have a TaqMan probe which adds additional specificity. So again, specificity could be lower if you're using a method like Cyber-Green method to amplify, but it can be higher if you use the probe-based RT-PCR method. But specificity is a measure that essentially applies to microarrays also, because a microarray is basically microarrays work by a hybridization of probe to microRNAs. So, and hybridization is never 100% specific. You can have one nucleotide mismatch, but still the probe will bind to the microRNA. So really the absolute correct or more correct method to quantify specific microRNAs is sequencing, where you actually sequence every single nucleotide. With RT-PCR, yes, specificity is an issue, but it depends on which microRNA. So some microRNAs is not that much of an issue. So we now come to another aspect of studying microRNAs, and that is how do you engineer microRNA studies. So if you have identified a particular microRNA which is of interest, or a particular targeting of an mRNA by a microRNA which is of interest, then you need to, if you need to study it further, you need to engineer microRNA levels. So engineering meaning either you want to overexpress the microRNA or you want to downregulate the expression of the microRNA. So again, general principle of genetics apply here. So if you want to overexpress the microRNA, you can overexpress the gene for the microRNA, for example, in a plasma, or you can overexpress the microRNA by transfecting the precursor RNA for the microRNA into cells. So you can get synthetic precursor microRNAs, and they can be transfected into cell inside the cells. They will get processed into mature microRNAs. And then in some cases you may be lucky. For example, microRNA 2-terminal, a microRNA whose expression in almost every cell goes up following hypoxia, because the gene for microRNA 2-terminal contains a hypoxia response element. And whenever the cells get exposed to hypoxia, you have this HRE-mediated transcription of the gene, so there's an increase in microRNA 210. So a simple way to overexpress microRNA 210 would be, for example, hypoxic exposure of the cells. for if you want to. So the one method which is most commonly used is transfection synthetic precursor microRNAs. So different companies actually sell these RNA molecules for so that you can overexpress a particular mature microRNA by transfecting these synthetic precursor microRNAs. And sometimes these precursor RNAs are conjugated to enhance the delivery. For example, when you have a three-prime for conjugation, so that the cells can are able to take in the precursor microRNA much more easily. Then they can have modifications like phosphorothioate modification, which helps the RNA survive longer in the cells because it increases the resistance to cellular nucleases. The problem with using precursor microRNAs is that because a single precursor microRNA can make two mature microRNAs, you can end up overexpressing two mature microRNAs instead of just one mature microRNA of interest. Then to reduce expression of microRNAs, which is basically knockdown of a microRNA, in cases like mice, you can have transient mice where you knock out the gene for a microRNA. And then there are other ways such as use of antisense oligonucleotides. These will basically bind to the mature microRNA and prevent it from binding to its target mRNA. Then people have come up with other methods. For example, you can have an artificial RNA which has no microRNA target sites for a particular microRNA. So if you overexpress or put an artificial RNA into cells, they will basically sequester the microRNA away from its natural targets. So effectively, you will have a biological knockdown of the microRNA activity. Even though the microRNA is still present, it's just being taken away by a non-specific target, and so it doesn't get to perform its biological function. Now, finally, there are some small molecule inhibitors, for example, some antibiotics are known to bind to precursor microRNAs. So people have used these small chemicals to effectively reduce microRNA levels in cells. Then, besides studying microRNA biology, what else have microRNAs been useful for? So, one application where microRNAs have really stood out is in the use of the microRNA biology for generating RNA interference in the short helical RNAs. So basically, you can design RNAs or something like siRNAs to knock out an RNA of your interest, and if you put it in the same precursor microRNA kind of construct, then these constructs are known to be much more effective at knocking down gene expression. So people have used the microRNA design to basically create shRNAs to knock down specific genes. Then people have used obviously microRNAs as biomarkers. This is, I would say, the most common application of microRNAs. Just like gene signatures or mRNA biomarkers, microRNAs have been used as biomarkers for different disease studies. And although it has been touted for long that microRNAs will be really useful for therapeutic purposes, there are not really that many in-use applications where microRNA therapeutics can be seen. So the advantage of microRNA microRNA biomarkers compared to mRNA biomarkers is that you have only 2,500 or so microRNAs. On the other hand, you have like 25,000 mRNAs. So the gene signatures that you get using microRNAs are more robust because you have only a smaller number of genes to examine. And the other advantage is, unlike mRNAs which get degraded in RNA samples stored outside the freezer, microRNAs tend to be preserved better in non-frozen samples. Finally, microRNAs can be identified in body fluids such as hair and urine and blood samples. So that's the other advantage of using microRNAs for biomarker studies. The disadvantage is that, as I mentioned, microRNAs are not generally have ubiquitous expression, so you see them in every cell. So they're like a cancer-specific microRNA. So you have to look at multiple microRNAs to see a signature. And but still, people have used these microns in interesting studies of biomarkers. So, as I said, unlike mRNAs, microRNAs are preserved well, even in tissues which have been kept at room temperature or frozen, sorry, or kept in formalin fixation. So, in this study, for example, from 2013, microRNA levels in frozen samples are being compared again the same sample which was instead fixed in formalin, and you can see good correlation. If you were to do this for mRNAs, you will see very poor correlation because once the mRNA gets into formalin, it gets degraded fast. Then we have in our lab shown, for example, that microRNAs can be kept in, for example, in blots, in dry tissue, sorry, blot on paper and kept at temperatures as high as 60 degrees, so for up to a month. And so this is so the main advantage really with microRNAs is that in a lot of hospitals and institutions where you have clinical studies going on, most of the time clinical samples are kept at room temperature in formalin fixed specimens. So you cannot do mRNA work with that very easily, but with microRNA you can very easily do a lot of studies with these samples. And then finally, the big advantage of microRNAs is that unlike mRNAs, they get into body fluids, and that happens because microRNAs are actually secreted by cells. So most cells actually secrete tiny, you know, 20, 15 nanometer diameter lipid-bound vesicles, and these vesicles, which are known as exosomes, they carry microRNAs within them. So if you were to collect blood, remove all the blood cells, and just look at the serum of the plasma component, you will have billions of exosomes in them. And these exosomes, they carry microRNAs as well. And because these exosomes are small, you don't have that many proteins or mRNAs in them, but you have abundant microRNAs in those exosomes. And these exosomes get into circulation, they enter into urine, saliva, tear fluid, and so this allows for use of microRNAs for non-invasive assays. Again, people have used this for specific examples to show the real utility. So it depends on the disease or the physiological condition you're studying. So in some cases, this is not of value, but in some cases, I will show you a few examples where it has been shown to be of great value. So because of the, this is one study where people have used microRNA biomarkers to identify cancers of unknown origin. So in some cancer patients, you see cancer metastasis in the lung or the brain, but you are never able to identify where the primary tumor is. And so in this particular case, they were able to use microRNAs to identify where the primary tumor was, just by looking at microRNA expression in these metastatic samples. So this is an outline of the algorithm that they used to measure different microRNAs and accordingly classify where the primary tumor origin is. Then this is another example of a successful use of microRNA biomarkers. So in lung cancer, non-small cell type of lung cancer, you have two common varieties of this cancer. You have the squamous cell carcinoma, and you also have an adenocarcinoma variety. And there are many ways to classify. So once you have a patient sample, you want to know which kind of subtype it is. You can do a histological examination. There are also protein and mRNA markers. But sometimes you may have small material, such as fine needle aspirate, or the biopsy specimen is too small to actually look at tissue morphology. And in those cases, you can extract RNA from small samples and measure microRNA levels. So in this case, they're showing that this particular microRNA, microRNA 205, is highly expressed in squamous cell carcinoma cells, but not in adenocarcinoma. So you can use levels of microRNA to quite accurately identify whether a cancer is squamous cell type or is it adenocarcinoma type. This is another example of a microRNA biomarker study. In this case, they're using serum or plasma microRNA levels to examine toxicity to the liver, which occurs in case of acetaminophen or Tylenol overdose. So typically when people overdose on this medication, it takes a few hours for blood enzymes to change because of the liver toxicity. But in this particular case, they're showing that microRNA-based measurement of the liver toxicity can be detected earlier and more sensitively than the standard enzyme-based assay. Finally, this is another example where people have used offer microRNA biomarker screening. So in this case, expression level of particular microRNA are being used to predict whether the patient is at a higher risk for recurrence of cancer of the lung following treatment or whether the person is at a lower risk. So again, typical of biomarker studies, these studies use a set of patients to train the data set, and then that is validated in a testing data set and additionally validated in an independent cohort. So this sort of design you see not just with microRNA studies, but with other biomarker studies. They could be protein or mRNA-based studies. This is another example where circulating microRNA in the plasma are being used to predict or diagnose transplant rejection. So in case of organ transplants, in some cases you have graft versus host disease where the transplant gets rejected. Usually it can take weeks or months to know whether the rejection has happened or not, and it may be too late, but in this case they are able to show that using particular microRNA in circulation, they can identify whether the rejection is happening and they can identify this much earlier than other methods. So again, microRNA biomarkers, there are thousands of studies if you look in the literature. And the value really depends on particular things that are being examined, the types of samples that are available, the time course you're interested in. So all the other things also come into play. But there are also many atypical examples. So people have actually identified that the breath that we exhale, it actually contains microRNA in it. So people have failed to use these exhaled breath microRNAs to diagnose particular types of lung diseases. People have used microRNAs to identify types of forensic body fluids. People have used microRNAs in stool samples. People have shown that chronic academic stress can change microRNA levels in blood. So there are all interesting studies also with microRNA. In terms of therapeutics, as I mentioned, there's not much. But the one thing which has gone into late clinical trials is use of a microRNA for treatment of hepatitis. So in this case, a particular microRNA, microRNA 122, was previously shown to be required for generation of viruses in case of hepatitis C infection. So this therapeutic method relied on use of an oligonucleotide, which basically binds to its microRNA and prevents it from acting, and that leads to disassembly of the viruses or less viruses being produced. There are some other microRNAs which have been used for cancers and other types of diseases such as atherosclerosis and kidney fibrosis, but most of them are either preclinical or early clinical studies. So this brings us to close this section. I think I'm already running. This is till 5:10, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have the time. Any questions? No. You want a break? We have like another 15 slides to go through. Okay, should we continue? Okay. So we come to the next section, which is about RNA editing. So there's really no connection between microRNAs and RNA editing, except that microRNAs can also get edited. So you probably have heard of genome editing, like the CRISPR-Cas9-based genome or DNA editing. RNA editing is different in the sense that here, when one is talking of editing, one is talking of, you know, the literary editor kind of editing action. So basically, if you consider RNA as a set of letters, A, T, C, and all that, the editing means change of one letter in one base type to another base type. So you have an RNA which contains a particular nucleotide at a particular position, editing means changing that nucleotide into another nucleotide. So this kind of editing can occur because if you look at structure of nucleotides that are present in RNA, one interesting thing that you will see that if you wanted to convert a C-valine or citrulline to a uridine or a uridine, all you need to do is remove an amine group from the citrulline nucleotide. So deamination of citrulline will result in a uridine being made. So to edit RNA, you can have an enzyme which will deamine citrulline, resulting in converting the sequence from C to U. Same thing can be done with A, the adenosine nucleotide. It also has an amine group. This can be removed by a deaminase enzyme, and that removal will generate an inosine residue. So inosine is like guanosine, it's like G basically. So if you have an RNA with an I in it, it is read as a G by cellular machinery during translation or transcription, a reverse transcription. And basically, you end up the A to I chain is effectively like an A to G kind of change. These kind of nucleotide changes have been known for a long time, and in different types of species, parasites, in mammals, in plants, and so forth. And you can also envision that, although it's not known, that the reverse can happen, right? If you can deaminate, you can theoretically also transfer an amino group to a U to make it into a C, or to an I to make it into an A. So again, this is theoretical. Nobody has actually shown it, but maybe it does happen. Again, this is a relatively new field. Although instances of editing have been known for a long time, the exact mechanisms, what is relevant, all that is coming into light relatively recently, mainly because of these next generation sequencing methods. So the A to I type of editing in mammals is known to be caused by three different ADAR proteins, ADAR proteins. And in case of humans, we have ADAR2, ADAR3, ADAR1. They can exist in different isoforms. And all the proteins are characterized by a double-stranded RNA binding protein, which allows the ADAR enzyme to bind to an RNA. And then they also have a catalytic domain, which is the deaminase domain, which allows for the enzymatic activity to occur, the deamination to occur. In case of these ADAR proteins, typically, they are present in the nucleus and they bind to double-stranded RNA. So double-stranded RNA can exist in a single RNA molecule because of regional sequence complementarity, and these stem loop kind of structures get recognized by ADAR protein, and they can convert, for example, E residue to an I, basically a G residue. These enzymes are also present in Drosophila, in C. elegans, and so forth. So you can see the consequence of an editing event. For example, if an A changes to an I, depending on where that change occurs, you can have multiple different types of results. You can have a change in the codon. So you can have a synonymous mutation, for example, a nonsense mutation, a missense mutation. All those are possible if this change occurs in the coding region, in the open reading frame. If it occurs elsewhere, you can have alternate splicing, you can have a change in the stability of the RNA, in transportation, etc., etc. So the impact of RNA editing can be high or it can be low. It depends on where exactly it is occurring. So one thing to remember is that editing is not non-specific. It's not like every A residue gets changed into an I or every C residue gets changed into a U. It usually has a sequence context. So you may have a 2000 nucleotide long RNA molecule with 500 C residues, but only one of them gets edited, and that's typically the case. So this is an interesting example of how does A to I RNA editing actually, what's the biological relevance of this? So this is a study from 2012, which was published in Science. So this group of researchers from Puerto Rico, they were interested in examining how do octopuses actually survive in cold temperatures. So you have octopus which are present at different latitudes. You have octopuses in the Antarctic region, in the tropical region, and so forth. So because at cold temperatures, the neuronal activity, the molecules which are important for survival, such as neuronal channels, etc., they can be affected because of the cold temperature. So what this group found was that it turns out that in the case of octopuses, there's a particular potassium channel gene, the RNA for which actually gets edited. And this editing occurs higher in cold temperature, at a higher level in cold temperature. So from the Antarctic, so the Arctic region, for example, the Antarctic region, you have higher levels of editing. On the other hand, from subtropical or tropical regions, you have a lower level of editing. So this editing of the channel allows it to function better at lower or higher temperature. And this was interesting because it showed the direct relevance of particular molecular event for organism or animal level survival. In case of C2U editing, C2U editing, as in case of mammals, is known to be caused by a group of proteins called APOBEC proteins. So the first APOBEC protein which is identified was the APOBEC1 protein or the APOBEC enzyme. And this enzyme is active in the small intestine. So what it does is it has a very specific role. It actually edits one particular RNA, which is the apolipoprotein B mRNA. So the product of this apolipoprotein B mRNA is a long protein, almost 5,000 amino acids long. And one component of this ApoB100 protein, one domain of it is required for it to be assembled into low density lipoproteins, this LDN receptor binding domain. On the other hand, in the small intestine, the ApoBEC1 protein is active. The RNA for ApoB100 gets edited, so you have a short protein made, about 2,000 amino acids, and this protein, which is a B48 isoform, actually cannot get incorporated into the LDLs, the low-density lipoproteins, because of it lacks the receptor binding domain, and instead it gets packed into chylomicrons. So this editing, specifically in small intestine, allows for absorbance of fat molecules during digestion process. So this is the first APOBEC protein which was identified, and the first discovery of C2U RNA editing in mammals was discovered back in the early 1990s. Since then, people have identified other members of this APOBEC family. There's APOBEC2, 4, APOBEC3, A, B, C, D, and so forth. So all these proteins are characterized by the presence of a citidine deaminase domain or CDA domain. So this deaminase domain, if you remember, is what causes the deamination or the removal of an amino group from a C to convert it into a U nucleotide. Some of these proteins are present in nucleus, some are in cytoplasm, some are distributed in both. People have shown that this deamination of C to a U can occur in case of DNA also, meaning these enzymes can act on DNA. And as I mentioned, some of them can act on RNA, like APOBEC1. And since then, we have shown in our lab that there are other APOBEC3 proteins, 3A, 3B, 3G, which can also cause this RNA editing to occur. We don't know the relevance of this editing in some of these cases, but it's shown that these APOBEC proteins are involved in many interesting biological phenomena, such as immunity against viruses, mutagenesis in cancer, retrotransposition, and so forth. So again, this provides a new angle to study some of these biological phenomena. Is it possible that RNA editing by the APOBEC proteins mediates some of these phenomena or not? So that's an interesting thing to study. So I'll briefly talk about how the APOBEC3A was discovered at Roswell as a C2U RNA editor. So first, we have been studying macrophages. So macrophages in the lab, you can generate macrophages from monocytes from blood. So you collect monocytes from patient donors, and you can grow them in tissue culture into macrophages. And then you can differentiate them into M1 or M2 type of macrophages. M1 are basically pro-inflammatory macrophages, and to our anti-inflammatory. So if you compare the RNA sequences of M1 and M2 macrophages, you can find it for many genes, a few hundred, you know, or 145 or so genes, you have changed the sequence of the RNA. So you see C2U type edit for about 122 genes, A2I or A2G type editing for about 15 genes, and these editings occur in M1, but not in M2 macrophages. So which was interesting, and so one of the genes which was edited was this SDHP RNA. The RNA for this gene getting C2U edited in M1 but not F2 macrophages. So we were interested in identifying what is the gene which causes this editing. And for that we looked at samples of the Cancer Genome Atlas project. So in this particular project we have a number of cancers which are profiled for RNA sequences, gene expression, mutation, etc. So we looked at three different types of cancers and we compared samples where there was evidence of SDHP RNA editing against samples which did not have evidence of editing. And in these three different types of cancers, we found that APOGAT3A was the gene whose expression was different between the editing positive and editing negative samples, indicating that maybe 3A is responsible for this RNA editing. And in fact, if you knock down in M1 macrophages using two different siRNAs, you see reduction in editing. And finally, if you were purify APOGAT3A and incubate it at SDHP RNA, you can see in vitro editing of the SDHP RNA. So this indicated that 3A indeed is an RNA editing enzyme. So this was the first or the second C2U RNA editing enzyme to be discovered after APOGAT1 in 1993. Since then we have been looking at the other APOGAT3s and we have seen activity for 3B, 3G, and so forth. So how do you assay for RNA editing? So one simple method is to just do Sanger sequencing. So in this example, we have identified for, in case of APOGAT3B, that there are two particular transcripts which are edited by this APOGAT3B protein, EPHA7 and SCNP2. So you can have, for example, have a particular cell line transfected with APOGAT3B, and then you can amplify the EPHA7 or SCNP2 RNA or cDNA, and then you can sequence them, and you can see that there's an, I'm sorry, the point is not working anymore, so I can bring the point out, but you can see, for example, when APOGAT3B is present, you see an editing of the serine, which is highlighted with this blue background, occurring as against in the empty vector control. Then RNA sequencing is another method. Basically, you sequence all the RNAs, and then you can align all the sequences against the genes they represent. And then because we have single nucleotide level data from the sequencing reads, you can look for what percentage of reads at a particular region have a change in nucleotide, and thereby guess if there's an editing occurring there or not. So these, such analysis of RNA sequencing data requires a lot of computational work, and there are a lot of people coming up to do this bioinformatics computation kind of workflows to analyze RNA sequencing data. So this is just like looking for mutation in DNA sequencing data. Finally, once you have identified editing of a particular gene at a particular position, you can do RT-PCR experiments to look for or to quantify the exact level of editing. So these RT-PCR experiments depend on two different primer sets. So one primer set is specific for an editing change, the other will be for the wild type kind of nucleotide at that position. And then if you were to compare the signal between the two primer sets, the PCR signal values that you get from the two primer sets, you can kind of measure how much editing is occurring. So in summary, what we know now is that RNAs with thousands of genes are edited, and that editing is not non-specific. It usually has a sequence context, and it is possible, again, depending on which sequence is getting edited, that editing can have a high impact at a protein level. So this provides a new angle to examine cellular phenomena And as I showed, editing can be physiologically effective. We have seen big differences in editing between M1 and M2 max pages. People have shown differences in editing level in all sites because of exposure to hypoxia and so forth. So in case of humans, A to G and the C to U types of editing, artificial other types of editing actually are not known. So the, in general, the field of editing has much to discover. So it is a very fertile field. It's prevalent across different cell types, diseases, or the mechanisms, how they modulate, what is the functional relevance. A lot has to be still available for discovery. So that brings us to the last topic of this lecture, which is RNA modification. So when we talk of RNA modifications, RNA modification can imply anything. For example, when you have precursor RNA get its intron spliced out, that's also a type of modification. If you have polyadenylation, the addition of the poly A tail to RNA, that's also a type of modification. So currently, when you're talking about RNA modification, we're not including these types of RNA modifications. Same way, transfer RNA molecules, you probably have read, have been known since the 50s and 60s to contain all the different types of RNA modifications. So again, we're not talking about those types of modifications. So in this particular case, in this lecture, when we say modification, we're talking about messenger RNA modification. So modifications really, you can imagine, sort of chemical change in the sugar or the nucleotide of the RNA bases. So about more than 100 types of RNA modifications are known. Most of them are methylation. And some of these modifications are reversible, some of them are not. So for example, you already know DNA gets methylated, for example, the CpG islands of DNA, and that's been known since the early 20th century. Methylation of RNA bases has been known since the 1960s. So these are some examples of modification. So you can have, for example, the A residue in an RNA modified at its N6 position by addition of a methyl group. So that's known as the N6A modification because you have the N6 residue of adenosine getting methylated. You have other modifications like 2'O methyl modification and so forth. So most of these modifications are methylation type. They are reversible. On the other hand, there are some modifications such as pseudouridylation, which are not reversible, so they are unidirectional. So people have a lot of interest in reversible or bidirectional kind of modification because you can think of biological phenomena where you have methylation and demethylation, for example, and the dynamic between those two dictating certain molecular events. So in this regard, the F6A modification has been studied recently a lot. So this is something like protein phosphorylation. So it was noticed in the 1970s where people thought that about 0.5%, 0.4% of all adenosine residues in cellular RNA gets this modification. And recent discoveries, again with next-gen sequencing technology, has allowed for further study. So right now it's believed that majority, maybe 60-70% of human gene transcripts are methylated at that 6th position adenosine residue. And this typically occurs in a particular sequence context, just like RNA editing, so it's not like every A residue gets methylation. It has to be in a particular context. And it is reversible, and people have shown that this is widespread across eukaryota, you see it in lower organisms, and you see it in humans. So there's a new field coming up, which is referred to as epitranscriptomics, which studies, this is something just like epigenetics. Instead of DNA methylation, you're studying, looking at RNA methylation. So in this regard, there are three things which people are interested in. One is what causes the methylation, what they refer to as writers, and what reverses the methylation, which is referred to as erasers. So you methylators, which create the methylation, they're the writers, you have erasers, the demethylators, which reverse the modification. So a number of enzymes which do this writing and erasing have been identified. The methyltransferase, like METTL3, 3 and 14 methylases, known to catalyze fortification humans. And then you have the FQ and ALKB5D methylases, which do the opposite. They remove the methylation, bringing it back to its original state. Then there are readers. So these readers are basically proteins which either recognize or don't recognize methylated adenosine residues. So again, a number of different readers have been identified. For example, there is YTH domain family proteins, which will bind strongly to methylated adenosine, but not to non-methylated adenosine. So you can imagine scenarios where you have higher methylation uptake, and that allows these proteins to bind strongly or less strongly, and thereby resulting in some subsequent phenomena. So these phenomena, these relevances are under active investigation. So again, it depends on what particular gene or cellular context is being studied. So people have shown, for example, that methylation of circadian clock gene transcripts can affect how fast you move from the nucleus. So regulation of circadian rhythm basically depends on this M6A modification. Same way, modification can affect iron stability. People have shown this as important for regulation of pluripotensis proteins in stem cells. People have shown that, and sometimes stress with this heat shock, the M6A methylation can affect RNA transmission. So the recent paper just came out last week or so, where people have shown that inactivation of gene transcription or reduction in gene transcription can also be affected by methylation. In this particular case, they showed that there's this target, which is important for inactivation of X chromosome gene. It needs to be methylated for it to recruit silencing proteins, which bind to the methylated regions of the list RNA, and that's important for it to be able to inactivate the X chromosome genes. And finally, this methylation associated writers, erasers, readers, these proteins are known to be dysregulated in cancer. So again, a lot of it is still under investigation, and I thought I'd present this to you so you have an idea about an emerging field. So M6A modification is just one modification. There are many others which are not understood. So I have a list of papers in this slide. If you're interested, you can look at them. There are some from the classics which talk about how something was discovered. These are original research articles. Then there are also some relatively recent reviews which give an overview of particular aspects of microRNA or RNA-DNA modification. So before I take questions, I just want to point out about the exam. I think this section covers maybe 5% or 7% of the points. And my exam will be multiple choice questions. I think there will be 4 or 5 questions. And I try to make my questions is that the question itself is a learning material. So even if you're not able to answer, you'll be able to learn some things. And I don't know if you get the answer key after some days, but if you do, the answer key also provides some additional learning material. This is an example question regarding microRNA, which was given in the test last year. So that's all for now. If you have questions, you can ask me now, you can email me, call me, or visit me in the lab.